I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is Islam in popular media. Last week on the show, we talked about how television is very much a window into the United States and how popular culture, whether it is television, film, music, is very much a window into a society at any given point. And that can speak to representations of nationalism, economics, geography, race, or religion. And that while these things oftentimes take place in fictionalized worlds, there are real-world implications of those depictions. And that is the subject of a new book by Rosemarie Pennington entitled Pop Islam, Seeing American Muslims in Popular Media, in which she goes through and discusses various forms of popular culture and how Muslims are depicted and what the impact of that is on the culture at large. So she starts by looking at the idea of the imagined Muslim in American popular media, and from there looks at depictions and how they stack up to this idea. And she starts with Ms. Marvel as a character who goes against so many of these depictions and these stereotypes, and then goes through the book looking at scripted television, comedy, reality television, and fashion magazines, and really gets into a lot of the complications of identity, visibility, and what it means both in the popular culture, but as well for people living their everyday lives and what it tells us about society. And the book is focused on American popular media, but as a country that consumes as much American culture as we do here in Canada, very much resonates with Canadian audiences as well. So when I first saw the book and went through it, I found it really well done, put together in a very engaging manner. And I was very pleased when Rosemarie was able to make some time for me to talk about the book. I very much enjoyed the conversation. Think you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Rosemarie Pennington. All right. And Rosemarie Pennington joins me now. Rosemarie, how are you today?
I'm doing really well. Thanks. Thanks for having me here.
I'm really happy to have you here to talk about Pop Islam. And let's start with the basis of material for the book, because when this first came to my attention, obviously the subtitle, Seeing American Muslims in popular media is a pretty broad area.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from a methodological perspective, you do stand-up comedy, you look at films and television. How did you actually go about trying to pick what you were going to look at and analyze for this book?
Yeah, it started with the launch of Marvel's Ms. Marvel series. And it was a moment where I was thinking about the fact that, you know, it was the best-selling series for Marvel that year. And it was this, you know, hyper accessible, hyper visible representation of an American Muslim experience, which obviously, you know, for me, popular is just sort of something that's embraced by a broad audience. And so I started to look around the American media landscape to see what are other media moments or media texts that are having that same kind of broad popular impact, even though it might be a different kind of audience, right? Like, you know, comic books are a type of audience versus the audience that watches reality TV, but it's all media that's reaching a very broad audience. And that's kind of what I was thinking about, where what is going to get these representations in front of the biggest number of eyes. And then sort of went from there and started looking at where in the literature on representations, where did I feel like something might be missing, or where were questions posed in other people's work that I could kind of start tackling and dealing with?
And when you're looking at this sort of material, when you're looking at starting with a comic book and searching out, obviously it's this representation of Muslim experiences, but does that have to be a defining feature of the character? And by that I mean, is it sort of a character whose identity as Muslim is central to how they're being portrayed or what their story is, as opposed to a character who is Muslim, but it's not necessarily central to the story being told.
I mean, it's a mix of those things, right? Because in the chapter on comedy, I talk about Aziz Ansari and Kumail Nanjiani's performances in Silicon Valley and Parks and Rec, right? And they're playing these characters who are ostensibly kind of culturally Muslim, right? They don't talk about being practicing Muslims in the show, but they do talk about having connections to Muslim families and a Muslim heritage, right?
Yep.
But it felt important to include them, even though that's kind of an ancillary representation, because there's not a lot of Muslims that appear in American popular media who are framed in non-problematic ways that, especially men, to sort of examine. And so for me, I sort of, you know, I weighed and thought about, are these guys worth including? And there's still sort of positive representations of people who are, you know, for a better understanding, like they are Muslims. It's sort of in the American imagination, right? You are from a Muslim country. Most people understand that means that you are a Muslim, whether or not you are practicing Islam. Right. And for me, that felt like it was enough, especially given the reach of those shows and the reach of those guys' comedy sort of post those shows too, right? They kind of blew up. But then someone like Ms. Marvel is Muslim through and through. Like, it's so important to her identity. And someone like Hisam Minhaj, who I also talk about in that chapter on comedy, who is very open about being a practicing Muslim, right? And it just felt like these are all these moments of engagement with Muslim identity and Muslim representation that aren't framing Muslims as negative in some way. Muslim men are almost always framed as sort of problematic and violent and are connected to terrorism. Mm-hmm. And I was just looking for representations in popular media that were moving us away from that kind of representation.
When you're looking at these sorts of materials, how important is the predetermined idea or the imagined Muslim? And that's how you start the book, by looking at America's imagined Muslims. How important is that in shaping the discussion? I mean, I grew up in the 90s, but I do remember, like, I loved 24 when it was on,
right,
for instance, right? Like that, and that's really how I was in high school when that was happening after 9/11. And that's kind of the first real representation that I remember seeing widely of Muslims. And of course, in that show, they're always the terrorists. So, you know, how much does that kind of determine how we have to approach these topics, that there is this, or there was this era, that first decade of the 21st century, that, at least in my memory, that's all we saw in terms of the representation of Muslims?
I mean, for me, it frames the whole project. And it's not just the 20th century or the 21st century. Like, this is representation that dates back centuries, right? That, you know, it's... When Europe was, you know, on the Crusades to the so-called Holy Lands, right? Like, this has deep, deep roots in, you know, so-called Western history and cultures, and the ways that Muslims have been framed. And I would say sort of post the Tehran hostage crisis of the late 1970s and the oil crisis too, sort of post those moments is when there's this real kind of upsurge in coverage of Muslims, especially in relation to terrorism, given what's happening in the Middle East. And all of this frames the work that I do in the book, because it is the backdrop of understanding in the United States, right? Like, Muslims are almost always terrorists. Muslim women are almost always in need of saving in some way, shape, or form. If you think about the rhetoric of the war in Afghanistan, directly post 9/11, it was all about, in addition to destroying the Taliban, saving Afghan women, right? Yeah. And so going into a project like this, for me, who I've done so much work on Muslim representation in different kinds of spaces, I was thinking about, like, are these things that are showing up in popular media challenging these old state notions? Are they reinforcing them? That had to frame everything. Because I think there's no point in doing this work if you're not considering it in relation to the history of what's come before, and thinking about, like, what are the producers responding to, right? Like, if you read Ms. Marvel, especially the first series where she's being introduced, it does feel like there are a lot of moments in that comic book where the writers and the producers, who were, I think it was almost all a Muslim creation team, you know, felt like they were speaking back to stereotypes and that history of Orientalism and Islamophobia. So for me, it's part and parcel of all that I did in the book.
Now, you mentioned the history of it and the way Muslims are represented. How much, and I'm curious, because I've always pegged the end of the Cold War is a significant shift where it used to be that the Soviets were always the bad guys in movies, right? If when you look at Rocky and The Hunt for Red October, right, the Soviets were always the antagonists in films. And then Cold War ends and scriptwriters and producers need new antagonists in their films, and they shift to a different form of an other. Do you track that in the book? And is it really that simple that in the United States, when you have these movies, when you have these TV shows, the search for an antagonist is just finding something that isn't American, quote unquote, like really othering a group of people?
I mean, I think it's not that simple, right? So the history of representation or misrepresentation of Muslims in the United States has a long history. Like one of the first wars we fought were against the Barbary pirates, right? And Peter Gottschalk in his book, I think American Heretics, talks about how, you know, what were the representations that were coming up of these people, these Barbary pirates, or anybody associated with them. And they were things that would show up in, you know, representations in the 80s, very similar kinds of ideas and rhetorics. It waxes and wanes, I think partly in relation to sort of geopolitics, but, you know, Muslims and Muslim cultures, even during the Cold War, were not portrayed in media in particularly positive lights, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about Indiana Jones, right? There's that, you know, very famous scene where he confronts someone in a market and sort of, you know, the guy is coming at him with a saber and he shoots him or something, right? But there's all these moments in these films where people who are Muslim or who are associated with countries that everyone imagines are Muslim, you know, in this homogenous sense, mm-hmm. they're never treated as like fully rational thinking mm-hmm. individuals, right? If they're not the villain, they're kind of villain adjacent. Right. So I would say it's not as simple as the Cold War ends, Russia's no longer a villain, we need new villains. I mean, there's a little bit of that, but it's also like they have been convenient others for a very long time. And so as the geopolitical situation changes, of course, because news coverage is saying Muslims are problems, politicians are saying Muslims are problems, popular media sort of chases after that too. Like it's always a sort of, you know, cycle of someone is making this become a major problem or issue in the zeitgeist, right? And everyone is sort of chasing after it.
And when you mentioned that, yeah, there tend to be villain or villain adjacent, how much is religion versus race in terms of the way in which Muslim people, like the skin tone, right? Like how much does that really play into it versus the religious side of it? Or is it, again, a case of othering and being able to cast people as outside the mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're very much wrapped up in one another, right? Like Islam has become a very racialized religion where people assume like the ideas that all Muslims are Arabs, right? That is the idea, homogenizing view, when the largest Muslim countries are in South Asia and Southeast Asia, right? There are a lot of African-American Muslims in the United States, but even here, right, the default is that, oh, yes, all Muslims are Arabs. Yeah. And so I think it is hard to disentangle race and religion when it comes to the treatment of Muslims in media. So, yeah, I think there's no easy answer for sure. That. They live together.
Right. Yeah. So you mentioned Ms. Marvel. Is that being kind of the tipping point or starting point for this? And what was it or is it about Ms. Marvel that is so different, that is so unique, that captured so much popular attention that made you want to or really drew you back into looking at this material from this perspective?
Yeah. I think for me, it's the fact that Ms. Marvel, you know, Kamala is, or Kamala, I have to remember. She's just living her life, right? And like Islam is just a part of her life, right? And so going to the mosque with her friend, even though she doesn't want to go, it's like any kid who's been forced to go to like Sunday school, right? Like doesn't really want to go, but is going to go to appease the parents. Like all the stuff around sort of her practice of Islam she has moments where she is struggling with it. Like all young people struggle with the things they grow up with, but it's never, the faith is never treated as something demonic or dangerous. And her relationship to it is never that she is doubting that she's Muslim. She just might be frustrated with certain things in relation to the religion and how it's practiced, right? And I think what for me was so striking is that you don't see that kind of reflection in most representations of Muslims, right? You might see a Muslim in prayer. Like that is a pretty stereotypical image that you see in representations of Muslims, whether it's good or bad, right? But you almost never see inside mosques. And then you almost never see imams in a light that is anything other than sort of rhetorically excited, right? Like it's always like, if you think about like, what are the representations of like imams that you've seen? It's usually like, they're very animated and animated in a way that that media and or politicians are trying to suggest is problematic. And there's this moment in Ms. Marvel where she goes to the mosque. Her parents have been worried because she's been sneaking out because she's a teenager. We all sneak out, right? Yeah. She's been sneaking out, makes her go talk to the imam about what she's been doing. And it's this, as I was reading the comic book, I was like holding my breath. I'm like, okay, what's going to happen? And it's just a moment of like, of discussion with an elder in your community where there's a lot of respect on both sides. And he's not trying to tell her she has to be any one particular kind of thing, but letting her sort of work through who she wants to be. And for me, that was the moment where I'm like, oh yes, I have to write about this now, because it does really feel like something different than what we have seen. Like she is just living her her multiple identities at once. And I think that's also important too, is that she's never reduced to any single one thing. She gets to be all of them. And I think that's so important when we're thinking about representation.
Right. And frankly, just storytelling in general, that people can be multifaceted and have different elements of their lives that are important to them. But at the same time, you have mentioned a couple of times the representation of men, Muslim men in media. Obviously with Ms. Marvel, it's different. So what is the gender elements to that character? And does that also contribute to being such a unique representation?
So the sort of way this is broken down historically is that Muslim men generally have been framed in popular and other kinds of media as violent, irrational, threatening, illogical. And Muslim women have almost always been portrayed as victims of Islam, victims of Muslim men. Even in news stories about like hijab bans and other kind of anti-Muslim things that are happening kind of in the United States as well as in Europe, they're still victims, right? Like women are almost always victims of something. And occasionally you'll get sort of the representation of a Muslim woman being sort of like a sexual threat to somebody, but most often they're victims, right? And so what is interesting in Ms. Marvel is that she's not a victim, right? She is someone who is going out and saving people. I think it's important that like the first Muslim to headline their comic book was a woman, because women have not been seen as threatening in the way that men have. And so you've got this story of this young girl's life, and you see her brother, who is someone who comes across as a very kind of conservative Muslim who might in a different set of hands come across as that threatening villain, but doesn't. You have the father who, again, as the older sort of Muslim elder in the household, could be treated as a sort of very authoritative and unyielding and unbending figure, which, again, Muslim men often are, especially in stories about, you know, young women growing up in Muslim households. And then the figure of the imam who shows up and is someone who is not threatening and sits and listens as Kamala. Yeah. Oh gosh,
this could be a long 4 years potentially.
As she's talking to him, and I think it's interesting because you have the story of this young girl who is going through so many things that young girls in the United States go through, regardless of race, religion, or ethnicity. But she's a Muslim girl who becomes a superhero, and you sort of watching her struggles with identity, and all of the people around her are treated as full figures. And is sort of fully thought out people, and the men too are really important. And it feels like it's important that she is the doorway to this more nuanced representation of Muslim men. And so you've got this gender dynamic that plays out in the comic book And I don't know that, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm, you know, discounting, I'm not giving the American public enough benefit of the doubt. I don't know that it would have worked quite the same way had that sort of character be a Muslim man who opened those doors. I think now that she has been out and so popular, right, and has showed up in movies and cartoons and video games as a playable character, I think it opens the doors for, you know, more nuanced Muslim representation, especially in comic books. But I think she was really important because of that, because she became a safe, accessible way for people to learn about American Muslim experiences. And then all the people around her also got to be more nuanced and more fully realized people.
Now, if it is important, or as you say, it is important that, or it mattered that it's a woman as Ms. Marvel, and that creates the opportunity to have more nuanced representations of Muslim men as well, does that not in some way almost reinforce some of these ideas that if it has to be presented initially in this way, that through Ms. Marvel, she's almost a softer character initially, that because she's a woman, people will be more accepting of some of these traits, and then we can have these representations of men. Does this not, at least in some way, reinforce some of these ideas, some of these stereotypes?
It does. And I mean, it's not, no representation is perfect and is going to get it all right.
Yeah.
But if you look at the landscape of historic Muslim representation, it is a better start than has happened in most American media. So it does. I think it's, you know, there's always a trade-off where it could at times reinforce that, which is why I think it's so important when you look at sort of the way the Muslim men in the comic book do come across, that they're not all these violent threats. And there is one character in that first run of the series who is a Muslim man who sort of is villainous, but it's not villainous in the way that Muslim men generally have been villainous in comic book representations. So I think even the comic book itself is sort of dealing with that a little bit. So yeah, it's not perfect, and it can reinforce that. And that is always something that whenever you're creating any representation is thinking about, what are you reinforcing in the creation of this thing? But at the same time, if you're in a landscape where there's not been a lot of positive representation, it's hard to figure out how to navigate it in a way where you're not reinforcing something that you don't want to be reinforcing.
Now, another area where I'm curious about a lot of these same dynamics is comedy. And you mentioned mm-hmm. Aziz Ansari, Hasan Minhaj, and among others. And one of the things that, again, from my perspective, that comedy and comedians are really good at is disarming topics and their audiences, quite frankly, that they can come in and through comedy are able to reduce some tension. So is that part of what Muslim comedians are doing, is acknowledging that there are these preconceptions of them as Muslims and using comedy to disarm the audience? And in the same way that Ms. Marvel is getting into the universality of the human experience of, you know, she doesn't want to go off with her parents, go to the temple, the same way that really all kids don't want to do that wherever their parents are taking them, the same way with what comedians are doing is they're telling stories and disarming and really kind of relating to their audience that, hey, we're all just people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the interesting thing in comedy is sometimes men can have an easier time of helping goes for whoever, you know, whatever their background is, disarming an audience than women sometimes, depending on the kinds of jokes you're telling.
Right.
If you're a man and you're talking about sort of, And all three of these comedians you've mentioned, Aziz, Kamal, and Hasan, have all sort of talked about like the specter of the scary Muslim terrorist, right, in their work. Like, you get people to sort of acknowledge, like, you acknowledge that, you get people to sort of laugh along with you about the absurdity of it, and then you kind of take them into something a bit deeper, right? And I think the problem that sometimes Muslim women or any female comedians face is that sometimes the things that they are trying to get the audience to acknowledge can be a little trickier, right? And then, you know, it's, you know, when you're making a joke about like facing sexual harassment constantly from right. people, and there's a audience full of men, it can be hard to get the men on board with that
sure.
joke.
Yeah.
So I think I'm just thinking about, since we came off of the discussion of gender, like that was sort of at the top of my mind. But even they sort of get to a space where they can disarm the audience. But people like Hasan and Kumail and Aziz, and now, you know, Rami Yusuf, are all really great at pointing out sort of the stereotypes and the hypocrisies and turning them around in a way where they point out how kind of ridiculous they are. They get the audience kind of laughing along with them. And then after they've got through that sort of tense moment, they start building these things, these, you know, stand-up specials or like, you know, the monologues on SNL, where at some point they're starting to sort of land these truth bombs about the difficulties of being a minority in the United States, particularly a Muslim minority, where people are still laughing. But I think in a way, I wouldn't say learning is necessarily happening, but I think there's some opening up that can happen through that, through the jokes. But yeah, it's all, you have to disarm your audience if you're going to have them with you, right? Because if you're a comedian and you can't do that quickly, then you're just going to bomb and no one's going to listen and pay attention.
Yeah. And I've gone to Montreal, the comedy festival there, a few times in my life. It's super fun. If anyone ever wants to go, it's a great excuse to go to Montreal in the middle of the summer. Although I don't think that actually happened this year, but it should be back next year. But the thing that I've always noticed is that women comedians, it feels like they have to be twice as funny to get the same reaction out of the room. Yeah. And it's really frustrating sometimes as an audience member, because there could be a woman up on stage, in my opinion, crushing it and not really getting the reaction that the male comedians are. And when we're looking at it from the perspective of Muslim representation, that strikes me as it even makes that job, what is already a very difficult job, that much harder, and having to disarm in two different ways, both on the area of sex and gender, and then also religion and race. Like it just seems like it's almost it's like climbing Everest, it feels like.
Yeah. I write about this in the book, but there was a roast battle between Dina Hesham and Eli Sayers, who are both well-known stand-up comedians in the New York area. And for me, when I was researching, it was one of the moments when I was the angriest working on the book, because I wanted to do this book because I wanted to do stuff that felt fun, because so much of my work can feel kind of depressing and frustrating. And I wanted I'm going to look at fun media for once. And I was watching, and I love stand-up comedy, and I was watching this roast battle to write about for the book, and Sayers, just all of his jokes, and again, it's a roast, but even so, all of his jokes are about her, some, you know, quote unquote, essential quality of who she is, about her Arabness, about her Muslimness, you sort of just leaning into all these horrific stereotypes and tropes about like her, you know, her father beating her at one point, I think is a possible joke that pops up. I can't remember. It's been a long time since I looked at it, but it's that kind of stuff, right? Where it's just like the most Islamophobic, Arab phobic stuff you can imagine. And she is, I think, friggin' hilarious. Like, she's got this kind of deadpan delivery, which I think just when she nails a joke, just makes everything so much funnier. Yeah. Right. And she was insulting him in ways like, you know, implying that he can't read or like random stuff that I thought like was really funny and kind of clever. But you could just sort of, just even watching the video and not having been there live, you can kind of feel how the room is going. Because it feels like for her to have made some of the jokes about him that he was making about her, like the audience would have like, you know, lit, you know, had pitchforks and lit torches, right? And like, you know, mobbed. She just couldn't work in the same kind of way. And you can sort of see her on the stage, you know, even though she's ripping out these like funny joke after funny joke, like it feels like you can feel her trying to figure out how to navigate that. It's just not safe for her to make the same kinds of jokes, right? And I think it points to the idea that to be a comedian, to be particularly a stand-up comedian, you have to be willing to be vulnerable in ways that I am uncomfortable. Like people who do stand-up comedy, no thank you. You are heroes to me. How you can get up there and like just open up to people and like be open to bombing in front of so many people. Like it's just, I don't know how they do it. Like it makes me want to puke thinking about it. But to sort of watch that happen, right? Like to be in this space that even though you're with people who think comedy is great, you still have to be vulnerable to do it. And to like have to watch her, like it was like racist stuff that was being thrown at her, and to have to stand there and take it, you know, it just felt terrible. It felt awful, and sort of the opposite of what should be happening in that space. And he won the battle, which was the most infuriating thing. Right. So yeah, I think, you know, as a Muslim woman comedian, you have to deal with the gender stuff. But there's also the stuff related to race. And if you are not a white Muslim, right, ethnicity, religion and or ethnicity and race. And it makes it so much, I think, more difficult for women sometimes, not all the times. So I think there are some comedians who work a room really well and sort of have seemed to navigate it, like Zainab Johnson, who I write about a little in the book. She's a Black American Muslim, is funny as heck, and sort of seems to like work rooms really well. But she's also not a big name in the way that Hasan Minhaj is a big name, right? I think there's still something about the kinds of jokes women tell that can make an audience a bit uncomfortable in a way that the jokes that men tell don't always.
Right. Now, another area where there's increased challenges, it's another chapter in the book, is reality TV. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I don't know how big the audience of reality TV is compared to some of these other things, but I watch a few of the shows mostly because I like some of the podcasts that come out of reality TV. To be honest, I like Rob Has a Podcast and sort of his network that he's built over there. So I watch some of the shows that they cover, not because I think the shows are necessarily great, but the stuff that comes after it, I really do enjoy. But it always does feel like, and they talk about this on the podcast a lot, that especially early on in the reality competition shows, if there's anything that sets you apart, it's an easy vote out early on. And there's been changes in the way things have been cast recently. But if you look at older seasons, it's always either the older woman who's voted out first or a minority who's voted out first. It tends to be how it goes. So when you're looking at reality television, how much of the balance is there between sort of reality competition versus like real world type shows, and are you looking at one, the way they're represented? Because I know editing matters in all shows, but I feel like in reality TV, editing is like the most important, because you can really shape any story the way you want to. And so is it really about narrative or outcomes when we're looking at reality television?
Yeah. So for the book, I was really looking at competition shows largely. There have been a few Muslim individuals who have started appearing on things that are like, I can't remember if there's a Real Housewife who is Muslim yet, but they're beginning to appear in those kinds of like real world kind of situation shows. When I started this work, I can't remember if there were any yet. There's a show called Shahs of Sunset, which I'm not sure if it's still on the air. It's about, you know, Iranian Americans living in Los Angeles. Not all of them were Muslim. And I had thought about writing about that, but Evelyn Al-Sultani had already written about them. I'm like, I don't need to do that one. So I looked at competition shows specifically because those shows are designed to make you want to root for somebody. And again, Muslims have generally in American media not been people you root for, right? You root against them. The interesting thing is that, you know, again, it's women who have found the most success in these spaces, but the stories are almost always trying to drill down to something essential about their identity, right? There was a contestant on MasterChef, Amanda Saab, she's a Muslim American, and during one of the challenges had to cook bacon, which pork is haram in Islam. So she cooked the bacon, never having cooked it, but then also I think put turmeric in the waffles she served it with. And everyone was like, oh my gosh, you did such a great job with this bacon you've never eaten. And you put this turmeric in this waffle, it just, you know, assigned to your heritage. And so there's always these moments on these shows where there is an attempt by the judges to try to like figure out or communicate to the audience who this person is. On Project Runway, this is probably the most successful Muslim American who's appeared on a reality TV show. Ayana Ife is a fashion designer, and she made it to the finals of her season of Project Runway. And her whole thing is that she wants to create modest fashion that's appealing to all kinds of Americans, like not just for a Muslim American audience or any other community that specifically looks for modesty, but really wants it to be accessible to a broad audience. And it was interesting where they liked her, but they always felt like she was holding back a little bit. And then when she started leaning into these designs that were very, very modest, but also kind of very fantastical, you'd see these judges like, oh, yes, this really feels like you in a way that sort of suggests like the more modest, the more it must be you.
Right.
You know, and again, and this is not to take away from her work, which was beautiful. Like she created some really cool stuff. But it's the way they talk about what she made that can be really frustrating, right? Because it suggests that they have some sense of who your real identity is based on your religion, right? Or where your family comes from. And that's the troubling thing with these reality TV shows is that, yes, they are positive representations. And we need more positive representations. But the way that the individuals who appear on these shows get talked about by the judges, who are sort of, you know, the stand-ins for the audience in some ways, is really frustrating and can sort of reinforce, to get back to your idea with like Ms. Marvel, can really reinforce more negative understandings of who Muslims are. If a, you know, if they're celebrating Amanda Saab for cooking bacon, is a bad Muslim suddenly someone who will eat the bacon, or someone who, you know, a bad American Muslim is someone who won't even cook the bacon, right?
Right. Yeah. I guess part of what I'm thinking about as you're talking is the idea of creative control, because with the scripted show, with Ms. Marvel, you can have the creatives be from the community. You can have them be right. Muslim creators. Same with the stand-up comedians, that they have creative control, especially most stand-ups when they do a special, they control the edit at the end too. So they are throughout the process controlling it. On reality television, the people who are represented on the show, the contestants, have no control. And it's really, as you say, the way it's edited is so important. The judging on these shows, right, standing in for the audience. But the fact that they don't have any creative control, how does that potentially play into the way you analyze the shows compared to things where it's being created by a Muslim?
Right. And that's something I think about a lot with the book. And I, you know, I, as I was working through this, my original hope was to be able to focus more on things that were being created by American Muslim creators. But while there's kind of been a bloom of those kinds of things in the last few years, when I was working on the book, there wasn't as much as I would have liked. And that's something that's a real tension in that, again, something like Ms. Marvel and those comedy specials, they do allow these moments of people having fuller understandings or fuller representations of the Muslim experience, because again, they're being created by Muslims. With something like reality TV, or, you know, the fashion magazines I write about, or even again, scripted shows that are in another chapter, you're sort of forced into a narrative someone else is creating about you, or about sort of the community that you come from, right? If you are a Muslim actor who's portraying, you know, a Muslim character. That is one of the tensions that I'm kind of working through the book, although I perhaps could have pulled that out more clearly, I think, in hindsight. Because you're at the mercy of the producer in the things that you have no creative control over, which has been the historic problem for American Muslims, is that most of the representations created of them or about them have not been by Muslim creators. Not that Muslim creators are going to create, you know, the most perfect representations either. There are problems with that too. But if you look at, you know, the attempts to course correct over the course of history, I'm thinking especially post 9/11 context, where there were shows like, there was one about a foreign exchange student, I think from, I think it was from Bangladesh or Pakistan, who moved to the United States. It was like early 2000s. And sort of the whole shtick of the show was like how everything was so new or strange for him coming from this other place. But the community he was in was also learning from him, right? So it was an attempt to try to do kind of cross-cultural communication. And, you know, it was a little heavy-handed, but sort of still felt like it fell back on a little bit of tropes. There was a show, All American Muslim, which was actually a reality TV show that was more akin to like Real World, where, again, it's a reality TV show, like the proof is in the editing, but it felt like it was attempting to be a better, fuller picture of American Muslim experiences in a real sense, right? A quote unquote real sense. Mm-hmm. But it was killed essentially by a conservative political group that drummed up a bunch of controversy around it, because it was just showing American Muslims living their lives. So even like these moments when reality TV attempts to do the right thing, it, you know, I think it was on TLC or Discovery. It was one of those channels, and they killed it. I think it was TLC. They killed it because of pressure, because this conservative group was getting advertisers to promise to withdraw advertising from their show. I don't know that I've answered your question very well. I think you caught me thinking out loud about a bunch of things.
No, it's great. And I think one of the things that, and as you mentioned, there are a couple chapters that we haven't had the chance to get to, scripted right. TV and fashion magazines. But I'm curious, just as sort of put a bow on our discussion here, you know, the book, and you've referenced it, the idea of the trap of visibility, that sometimes visibility is good, but that's not always the case. And it really is a tough wire to walk for the people who are creating this content. But I'm also curious, from the audience perspective, how would you advise audiences to be real critical consumers of media? I've had the chance to teach a couple classes related to popular culture, and I always encourage the students to be critical of what you're watching, and not critical in the negative sense all the time, but just critical consumers, and try to understand what is being presented to you, why it's being presented to you, what do the messages mean, and just try to understand what the motivation is of the person who created it. But that's big idea, hard to do in practice sometimes. So as someone who has really done a wonderful job with this book and all your other work, how do you, and I'm sure you get asked this somewhat frequently by friends, people in your life, how would you advise people to be critical consumers of media in their day-to-day lives?
So I think it is a big question, and I usually have a big answer. I think the easiest way is to, when you're seeing your representation of any group, insert any group, right, in media, ask yourself, how would I feel if this was my community being represented in this way? I think that is the first easy thing to do that requires no Googling or all the other things I would suggest people do, right? How would I feel if it was my community? And then I would, you know, I would ask myself, like, who benefits from the representations that I'm seeing? Like, right? Like, and if it's something that I find challenging, I would ask myself, why is it challenging me? Like, and challenging, it could be bothering. Why is this thing bothering me? Or if it's challenging in a different kind of way, then like, why? Like, what is it that is sticking with me? Like, is it because it's different? It's new? It's saying something that is an uncomfortable truth that I don't want to recognize? And I think those are like reflections you can just do in the consuming of the media, right? And then I think if you really are interested, I think, you know, figuring out like who is the creator, and then Googling is very easy, or, you know, doing a quick search and figuring out who is this person. And if you are watching something and something smells off as you're watching it, and then you Google it and you find out, well, this producer has produced 4 other TV shows that I have hated, right? Then you got to get a sense and what is their agenda? And like, you do a little more digging. I mean, that's the thing that I would go to, is just, you know, first, like, what is bothering me? How would I feel if this was my group being represented this way? And how, you know, I think it's always good to ask, how does this fit in with how I see the world too? And if it's a disjuncture with how you see the world, I think that's a place of like reflection, right? Like, okay, if this is not how I understood this happening, why? Which again are all things that don't require too much work, except for like you stopping and thinking about it in the moment.
Yeah. And that's really an important thing, is actually taking the time to sit and reflect and think about what we are consuming. And this book is a wonderful avenue to do that. So again, it is Pop Islam, Seeing American Muslims in Popular Media, Rosemary Pennington. If people want to pick up a copy of the book or check out all your other work, what's the best way for them to keep up with everything you got going on?
You can find the book at IU Press's website, and I'm on Twitter at Rom Penny.
All right, and we will link to all that down in the show notes. Again, really enjoyed the discussion. Encourage you to check it out. Rosemary Pennington, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for the interest in the book.
So there you have it, my chat with Rosemary Pennington, and I thank her for her time. And again, the book is Pop Islam, Seeing American Muslims in Popular Media. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from National Public Radio, a perspective column by Annika Steffen entitled, Ms. Marvel Treats Being Muslim as Ordinary, and That Makes It Extraordinary, from June 17th, 2022. 2. And in this article, Annika talks about Ms. Marvel in very similar ways that Rosemary talks about Ms. Marvel, as being a character who is presented as unapologetically Muslim, which is how the character is presented in the film and described in the article. But at the same time, she's an American everyday teenager going through the typical everyday American teenager things that teenagers go through, and how that is so different from typical depictions. And the article goes on to talk about her appearance. She's not wearing a hijab, and she isn't rebelling against disapproving parents. There's all these subheadings through the article that highlight how the character is challenging the conventional ways in which Muslim characters are presented, in particular, Muslim young women are presented in popular media. So the article goes through that and then also talks about how it is personally meaningful to Annika to see this representation, to see it on the big screen, and why it is so meaningful and powerful for her to see that representation on the big screen in the film. It's a wonderful article that I would certainly encourage you to read. And it gets into, in a different avenue, a lot of the same things that Rosemary was talking about, both in our conversation and in the book. So as always, you can find the link to that down in the show notes. That's today's historical headline of the week from June 17th, 2022 by Annika Steffen. Ms. Marvel treats being Muslim as ordinary, and that makes it extraordinary. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you haven't already, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Like, rate, comment. All that good stuff helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus a lot of the great written material over there on the website. Some great stuff in the last week, so I would encourage you to head on over and check it out. And of course, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, whatsoldisnews@gmail.com. So with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you next Wednesday for more What's Old is News.